This podcast features graphic details of real events taken from letters written by inmates convicted of murder. Listener discretion is advised.
My first cellmate told the guards on Sunday morning that I told him I was going to kill a guard to seek the death penalty. Two of them pulled me out and beat me really bad. I knew I should have killed my first cellmate when I had the chance.
These are the written words of Florida Department of Corrections inmate number 105559, Ricardo Gill. They're taken from letters that he wrote to us in 2018 and 2019. My name is Zoe Hines, and Ricardo Gill is one of over 2,000 inmates my colleague Ned Parker and I have corresponded with in our work as documentary producers.
This is Letters from a Killer, a Podimo podcast. Episode 9, Murder Me.
It's July the 8th, 2005, and in the bustling humidity of a Florida courtroom, there's a standoff. Convicted murderer Ricardo Gill is demanding to be executed, and he's holding the very justice system ransom, threatening to kill again if he doesn't get his way.
Your Honor, this case can end with the imposition of the death penalty today. Please make the right decision and don't be the fault of another loss of life.
But just 4 years earlier, Ricardo Gill was deemed too mentally ill to put to death. And it could be argued that his wish to commit suicide by stake is, in itself, evidence of mental instability. Surely the courts can't negotiate justice this way and just give Gill what he wants. Surely that would suggest that over 4 years, Ricardo Gill has somehow grown sane enough to be killed.
This episode comes in two chapters. Our first chapter in Ricardo Gill's story isn't simply about the murder that saw him sent to prison in the first place. It's also about what happened after he was incarcerated.
Our second chapter tells the story of how Gill attempted to control the court and force them to sentence him to death. Let's start at the beginning and hear the details of the first crime committed by our letter writer, Ricardo Gill.
Letters from a Killer. Case file. The following details are taken from official news reports and court documents. From a young age, Ricardo Gill was in constant trouble with the law. He was sent to prison for a string of offenses, including burglary, grand theft auto, and arson. But in 1999, having been out of prison for just 11 months, he entered the home of travel agent Beverly Moore. Gill apparently broke in with the intent of burglarizing her house, but this robbery seemed to go tragically wrong. During a struggle, Gill murdered Moore. He beat and stabbed her to death using a knife from her own kitchen. Moore's body was later found by her son. She had succumbed to multiple stab wounds and a slashed throat. But Ricardo Gill's story doesn't end with the death of Beverly Moore, because just 4 days after being sentenced, he killed again. This time, from inside the walls of his Florida jail cell.
The first thing to note is that, by virtue of the subsequent twists and turns in this case, it's almost easy to move past Beverly Moore's murder without pause. But this victim deserves us to stop and acknowledge what Ricardo Gill put her through before we move on to talk about his subsequent crimes. Beverly was a career woman and a mother of two, and her horrific murder was a surprise attack carried out by a man she seemingly trusted.
Ricardo Gill did write to us about Beverly Moore and her murder, and the way he talks about her potentially tells us a lot about his state of mind and the way that he sees the world and his place in it.
Let's hear the first extract from Gill's letters. As ever, these passages are read by an actor, but they are Ricardo Gill's words, as written to us from prison.
I had met Beverly about a month prior. Her goal was to bring people home with her on a Saturday night and do whatever it takes to convince them to attend church with her the next day. The church was a local church and accepted people of all races and origins. Beverly was white, a natural red, as she was interracial and everything. The actual night of the murder, she insisted I go to her place for sex, and I was really busy and needed to attend other matters. I worked in a car dealership, and there is where I became knowing of the clubs and downtown spots. It caused me heavy drinking and drugs, marijuana. I also became late in paying bills, etc., and in debt.
Gil's narrative jumps about all over the place here, and it's not always entirely clear what it is he's trying to say. In the next part of Gil's letters, he writes about the murder of his victim, and he does so in graphic detail. But what is noticeable is he seems next to start to point the blame for the attack on his victim, Beverly Moore.
I went to Beverly's place, and we spoke for a while. She then asked me to come to bed with her and have sex with her. After that, she fell asleep, and when I got up and got dressed to leave, she woke up and demanded I get back in bed and stay with her. I had to go home and be up for work the next day. I went to the kitchen and grabbed a knife and something to drink and returned to bed. When I completed the drink, I stabbed her once. She asked me to leave and said she would not report me as she called 911. I didn't believe her and stabbed her multiple more times.
That is one of the more bizarre accounts of a murder I've ever encountered. I went to the kitchen, got a knife and a drink, went back to bed, completed the drink and then stabbed her. It's really detached. Like murder was just another task to be completed after Gil had finished his drink.
It is a very strange letter. On the one hand, it's kind of very matter of fact, but he digresses all the time. And that actually makes it difficult to understand the timeline of events from what he's written.
When you first pick up Gil's letters, the phrasing and the sort of beautiful cursive handwriting they're comprised of gives you the impression that this is a writer with a certain level of education. And he likely is an intelligent man. But as you read these letters, you can see the logic of the content just seems to break down.
Let's return to Gil's letters and hear more of the struggle that ensued between him and his victim, Beverly Moore. Because despite being stabbed multiple times, Beverly was still alive.
She got up and fought. She made it to the kitchen where the phone was located, and she fell there as I cut the throat area. And she was now deceased. I went outside and cleaned up some, and then went back in and got my clothes and got dressed outside. I left and got a friend to come over with me and help me get some pricey things out of her home so I could pay some bills I owed. I was arrested 3 days later as I came home from work.
It's always sad for me when a person who took an individual's life writes to us about their victim's resistance. It's the fact that they're acknowledging a moment where things could have been different, and that moment was in their hands. And Gil follows the statement here that Beverly got up and fought with an exclamation mark. So he's clearly trying to communicate surprise that Beverly even tried to defend herself.
For me, it's the stark way that he describes some of these events. How he says that after they go to the kitchen, I cut the throat area and she was now deceased. It sounds like a dissection. It sounds like he's performing a medical procedure or it's something abstract. It's so nondescript in the way that he writes that, that it almost feels disinterested.
And then in his subsequent paragraph, Gil carries on that kind of writing. He talks about his comings and goings to fetch pricey things from Beverly's home to pay bills he owed. Is this Gil trying to suggest that he committed this crime for money? It's certainly not the only time it feels like he's trying to seed possible excuses for the murder.
Let's return to Gil's letters and hear a brief excerpt on how he felt about his arrest.
When I was arrested over the Beverly Moore case, I was shocked very much. I didn't think I would be caught, much less arrested. I was in complete denial of the entire thing.
Listeners can't see the letter that we've got in front of us, but again here, Gil uses another exclamation mark. And I note that he uses a lot of exclamation marks in his letters. He uses one at the end here after saying that he was in denial of the entire thing, exclamation mark. We could be reading too much into it, but for me, it's a strange place there to put it. And it's just generally a very kind of strange way of writing that he has.
So linguistically speaking, exclamation marks are an acknowledgement of your reader. It's the writer flagging that the directly preceding words are something to be interpreted emphatically, as in, pay attention to what I've just said, it's important. They force your interpretation of words and tell you how to consume that sentence. And I definitely think Gil generally uses exclamation marks as a way of trying to convey emotion when he's written something that otherwise might seem very abstract or disconnected. However, in this instance, I think he's trying to convince us of something he knows is very unlikely, that he genuinely never anticipated any repercussions.
Let's move on to the next chapter of Gil's story. Despite the fact that he was sentenced to life in prison for the murder of Beverly Moore, Gil had requested the death penalty at trial, but it hadn't been given to him because the judge declared that Gil was mentally impaired and suffering from mental health issues. So therefore he went to prison, and just 4 days later, Gil killed his cellmate. And Gil writes to us about that decision in this next extract.
I had a cellmate, whom I knew in prior prison time, who was seeking protection status, and he lied to the guards about me, and I was moved to a cell by myself. Then, Orlando Rosello was placed in my cell in the early hours of the next day. My first cellmate then told the guards on Sunday morning that I told him I was going to kill a guard to seek the death penalty. Two of them pulled me out and beat me really bad. I knew I should have killed my first cellmate when I had the chance. The only thing I knew now was I had to get out of this confinement. I then planned how and who I was going to kill to get out of here. Orlando Rosello. I wrote several letters to the judge and the prison warden. I mailed them out that night, and in the early hours of Monday morning, I strangled Orlando Rosello.
Let's start by addressing the first revelation here, which is that Gil actually had a different cellmate just before Orlando Rosello.
This was a man called Charles Wooden, aka Shorty Black. Gil claims that this previous cellmate lied to the guards and said that Gil was, quote, going to kill a guard to seek the death penalty. Now, we did reach out to Charles Wooden to try and get confirmation of this, but he didn't respond to the numerous letters we sent. But we do know that he was serving time at that point for grand theft firearm, which means he'd stolen a lot of weapons. And he'd also already been in prison for armed burglary, for dealing cocaine, and he'd returned to prison for aggravated assault and burglary. And Charles Wooden, Shorty Black, is a tattooed 6-foot-plus guy, over 200 pounds, and he is definitely not what you would consider to be an easy target. So for a man like this to have told the guards whatever it is that he told them to get out of that cell, he must have felt threatened by Ricardo Gil.
I knew I should have killed my first cellmate when I had the chance.
Here's what reports say actually happened on the morning that Gil killed his cellmate Orlando Rosello. It turns out that Gil waited until just before the guards would come round with breakfast at 5 a.m, so he was timing this perfectly. And it was then that he took a piece of bedsheet that he'd already torn and he wrapped it around the victim's neck and he strangled him to death. And after he killed him, he covered Rosello's face with a t-shirt because it had gone black and his tongue was hanging out. Breakfast was then apparently served to his cell, and he ate it. He then flushed Rosello's breakfast down the toilet and also flushed the bedsheet and an incriminating piece of paper on which he had written the words, "I kill at 5 a.m. And he flushed that piece of paper down the toilet as well.
I do want to point out another interesting fact, and that is that Gill is also reported to have said that he was able to block all emotional feeling and put his mind in a state where he was ready to take someone's life. So we're beginning to build a picture of a man who has a disjointed view of the world.
So let's now discuss the mental state of our letter writer and his capacity or lack of capacity for rational thought. He's wanting to die, by his own words. He is wanting to be executed by the state. Is that an indication of mental illness, of madness, or is it an indication of calculated thought? Or what do we actually know about his mental condition?
So there are two elements to Ricardo Gil's medical and behavioural history that I think we should acknowledge. The first is that he was actually institutionalised from the age of 10 because of mental and behavioural problems. He had counselling at an early age, and his record of offences began from the age of 17. So we are talking about somebody with a history of behavioural issues stemming from their early life. The second factor is that Gil was, in fact, at one point hospitalised, and it was discovered that he does actually have a brain anomaly referred to as an arteriovenous malformation, which is essentially a brain lesion made up of an overgrowth of veins and arteries that can hemorrhage. So this could absolutely have played a part in Gil's childhood history of what is known as discontrol syndromes and behavioural abnormalities. And essentially, it's said that a malformation like this interrupts the ability of a person to learn from his or her experiences. So once you start thinking about the threats, Gil's pattern of behaviour in light of these factors, I do think, regardless of our lack of medical knowledge, they're important factors to consider.
Initially, Ricardo Gil avoided the death sentence, despite having requested it, and this is because the judge deemed him to be too mentally ill to be executed. And that's because in the US they have this provision that the death penalty can only be used on somebody who is deemed to be mentally competent.
In 2002, the Supreme Court made it illegal to execute the intellectually disabled. Subsequently, there's been lots of discussion about what that phrase constitutes, and Gil's mental capacity, the illnesses that he was diagnosed with, certainly seemed to put his case into the field of that discussion.
Now, at this point in Ricardo Gil's story, after having killed Beverly Moore and having been incarcerated and then killed Orlando Rosello while under the care of the state in prison, Gil then returned to the courts to be tried again. Here's a reenactment of how he addressed the court.
Your Honor, this case can end with the imposition of the death penalty today. The case is then guaranteed a direct appeal, but less likely to be overturned, as the courts have found me competent in every step of the way, and that every decision made by me was knowingly, freely, and willingly. And furthermore, you will save an innocent human life. On the flip side, if I am given life, something I do not want, there are no appeals, and I don't want to have an opportunity to take another human's life. I understand that death penalties are not given due to threats, and the courts do not rely on such threats, but for you to take my statements and promises, which is what they are and proven to be, with a grain of salt, you will be second on a string of judges who have come to deliberately give me a license to take another human's life, knowing that the judges in this circuit will never give me the death penalty. Please make the right decision, and don't be the fault of another loss of life. I may take longer than 4 days next time, but it will be done, and I am 100% sure that it won't be an inmate the next time.
So to recap here, what we've got is an individual who has a history of mental illness, a history of criminal behaviour, who's committed a murder, that of Beverly Moore, for which he's been brought to trial, and at that trial he had requested the death penalty. But the death penalty was denied because he was deemed to be essentially intellectually disabled. Instead, he's sent to prison for life, but there he kills his cellmate and threatens to kill again if the death penalty is still not granted. Gill writes briefly about the second murder trial in his letters to us.
I had to fire attorneys and represent myself so I could dictate the court and proceedings. When the judge heard me, I knew he would give me what I wanted.
Now, what Gill wanted, as we know, was to be sentenced to death, and we're hearing that very much in his own words. This is a really extreme level of control that he seems to feel he could exert on the court. He even uses the word himself, dictate.
He's essentially holding the justice system hostage. He's saying, if you don't give me what I want, which is the death penalty, I will make you culpable for another life. First and foremost, I think that's an incredibly rare situation for an inmate to try and put the system in. But as frightening as it must have been to consider his threats literally, it does seem to me that no functioning justice system could say, okay, well, if you're going to do that, then we'd better do what you ask, without undermining its own integrity.
This is such an unusual scenario, and it is not something that I've come across anywhere before. We have had writers who've requested the death penalty, such as our letter writer for the last episode, Frank Ross, but this scenario of multiple murders and essentially holding the system accountable and responsible for your own violent actions is just unique. There is, of course, a lot of debate about the death penalty as a suitable punishment, but a large part of what people who are in favour of the death penalty claim is that it should be there because it can act as some sort of a deterrent. But here is Gill committing the crimes because he wants that punishment, and as such it just completely takes the legs away from the judicial system which is judging him. The case of Ricardo Gill is essentially making a mockery of the US legal system in regards to the death penalty. They have stated that Gill is someone who is not mentally capable and therefore he can't be executed despite the fact that he's requested it, despite the fact that he has said that he will continue to pose a risk to others. And the irony in all of this is that they finally say that they will give him what he apparently wants, which is that they will sentence him to death. But of course, the average life expectancy for someone on death row is actually 17 years. They don't execute people immediately. So this individual, Ricardo Gill, is now sentenced to death, but is returned once again, essentially to general population, in a prison, and he's been there now for the best part of 2 decades. And astonishingly, he then, from death row, writes directly to the governor who is yet to sign his death warrant. And here's what Gill wrote.
I have been waiting 18 years for the governor to sign my warrant. I have been without attorneys or appeals. No appeals. And I've even written to the governor several letters of threats to him and his family if he won't sign the warrant. He will not sign it.
It is hard to take a threat like that seriously from Ricardo Gill's position behind bars. How is he actually going to get out and kill the governor and his family? However, what we've seen to date is an example of the lengths that this man will go to follow through with what he's threatening. Gill is undeniably a man who has history saying he's going to do something, then doing it.
Now, obviously, we're not advocating that Gill should have been sentenced to death, or that they should carry out this death sentence, which he has been awarded. But keeping this person in general population, or even in death row, doesn't feel to me like this is really the right place for him.
A lot of the inmates we write to are very forthcoming. They're very keen to put their side of the story across. Some even, I think, want to offer some comfort to the victims' families and somehow think that participating in a documentary might help with that. Not so much with Ricardo Gill, who begins to try and influence our correspondence to his advantage.
I would like to speak to you about attorney and funds on visitations I'm continuously being denied. I'll be sure to make that part of the interview.
Gill was very demanding, and he wanted responses to his letters immediately, And he went a bit mad at us because he'd sent a Happy Christmas greeting via email and seemingly was very angry when he didn't get an immediate response to that. And from that point on, it all came out.
I kind of knew that you would ignore me in my emails, as well as look into everything I wrote and answering the questions. That's why I answered falsely. Make your show of what you got, because there is no interview taking place.
In the same way that he was trying to hold the court hostage and control his own sentencing, here's Ricardo Gil now trying to control us, telling us that you're going to be open with us, and then confessing that you've not been and retracting your offer of an interview. There's this whole sense of manipulation and control emerging. And there's a sadness to it as well. I never trusted you in the first place.
Ricardo Gil is a man who has no control over his own life. And I think that he is someone who is desperately trying to seek control of events in any way that he can. He doesn't have control over lawyers. He doesn't have control over the staff at the institution or his fellow prisoners. He can't do anything apart from sit in the cell every day or, as we've seen, act out violently and threaten or even murder his cellmates.
But this is a tangible way that he can have control over a situation in which he's communicating with filmmakers on the other side of the Atlantic and saying, yes, I'll tell you my story, or no, I won't, or I'll tell you the bits I like, the way I like, or I'll lie to you if I want. It screams to me of somebody who has no options. He is grasping at any level of being able to control events in any way that he can. And the one thing I would say about responses like this is that more often than not, a month or two down the line, we'll actually receive a letter again from that person. As yet, we haven't heard any more from Ricardo Gil since this correspondence, but it really wouldn't surprise me if we heard again from him in future.
Letters from a Killer. The Verdict. The following details are taken from official news reports and court documents. July 2005. After being found competent to stand trial, Ricardo Gil pleaded guilty to the murder of Beverly Moore. He waived a sentencing jury and any presentation of mitigating factors. Further to this, he agreed that the state could proceed immediately with its presentation of aggravating circumstances. June 2006. After analyzing the mitigating factors of Gil's deteriorating mental state against the aggravating factors of the offense being cold and premeditated, the court finally gave Gil what he wanted and sentenced him to death for the murder of Orlando Rosello. He is still on death row in Florida, waiting for his penalty to be acted upon.
In this episode, we've explored the words of Ricardo Gil and the incredibly complex case behind the letters we've received.
I will implicate myself in a crime that will result in my death.
We discuss themes of aggression and control.
Don't be the fault of another loss of life.
We've also discussed themes of the mental states of prisoners and how they're assessed. After such a clear and concise threat, should Gil have been watched more closely, or is it an untenable and costly exercise to monitor every single prisoner who uses threats in the way that Gil did?
Whatever we think of Ricardo Gil and his mental state, it is still chilling to consider that perhaps he saw the act of murder as a tool that could be used to get exactly what he wanted. And perhaps this makes the very act of murder itself the ultimate form of control.
Next time on Letters from a Killer. Cop Killer.
I wish I could say what his intent would have been, had he been able to get his weapon trained on me. Would he have lived? Would he have arrested me? In such situations, the fight or flee instinct kicks into overdrive, and I was forced to fight. So I fought.
Letters from a Killer was hosted by Zoe Hines and Ned Parker, and is a Podimo podcast by Transistor Films. Support the show by sharing on social media and following the podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.